Chapter 39. Certainly merit their misfortunes. Hadn't you better, now that Miss Sedley is free, propose for her yourself, William? Miss Anne asked sarcastically. He would be a most eligible family connection.
I marry her, Dobbin said, blushing very much, and talking quick. If you are so ready, young ladies, to chop and change, do you suppose that she is? Laugh and sneer at that angel. She can't hear it, and she's miserable and unfortunate, and deserves to be laughed at. Go on joking, Anne. You're the wit of the family, and the others like to hear it. I must tell you again we're not in a barrack, William, Miss Anne remarked. In a barrack, by Jove, I wish anybody in a barrack would say what you do, cried out this aroused British lion. Should like to hear a man breathe a word against her, by Jupiter. But men don't talk in this way, Anne. It's only women who get together and hiss, and shriek, and cackle. There, get away, don't begin to cry. I only said you were a couple of geese, Will Dobbin said, perceiving Miss Anne's pink eyes were beginning to moisten as usual. L, you're not geese, you're swans, anything you like, only do leave Miss Sedley alone. Anything like William's infatuation about that silly little flirting, ogling thing was never known, the mama and sisters agreed together in thinking. And they trembled lest, her engagement being off with Osborne, she should take up immediately her other admirer and captain. In which forebodings these worthy young women no doubt judged according to the best of their experience. Or rather, for as yet they had had no opportunities of marrying, or of jilting, according to their own notions of right and wrong. It is a mercy, Mama, that the regiment is ordered abroad, the girl said. His danger, at any rate, is spared our brother. Such, indeed, was the fact, and so it is that the French Emperor comes in to perform a part in this domestic comedy of Vanity Fair which we are now playing, and which would never have been enacted without the intervention of this august mute personage. It was he that ruined the Bourbons and Mr. John Sedley. It was he whose arrival in his capital called up all France in arms to defend him there, and all Europe to oust him. While the French nation and army were swearing fidelity round the eagles in the Champ de Mars, four mighty European hosts were getting in motion for the great chasse illégale, and one of these was a British army, of which two heroes of ours, Captain Dobbin and Captain Osborne, formed a portion. The news of Napoleon's escape and landing was received by the gallant TH with a fiery delight and enthusiasm, which everybody can understand who knows that famous corps. From the colonel to the smallest drummer in the regiment, all were filled with hope and ambition and patriotic fury, and thanked the French Emperor as for a personal kindness in coming to disturb the peace of Europe. Now was the time the TH had so long panted for, to show their comrades in arms that they could fight as well as the peninsular veterans, and that all the pluck and valor of the TH had not been killed by the West Indies and the yellow fever. Stubble and Spoony looked to get their companies without purchase. Before the end of the campaign, which he resolved to share, Mrs. Major O'Dowd hoped to write herself Mrs. Colonel O'Dowd, C.B.B. Our two friends, Dobbin and Osborne, were quite as much excited as the rest. And each in his way, Mr. Dobbin very quietly, Mr. Osborne very loudly and energetically, was bent upon doing his duty, and gaining his share of honor and distinction. The agitation thrilling through the country and army in consequence of this news was so great, that private matters were little heeded. And hence probably George Osborne, just gazetted to his company, busy with preparations for the march, which must come inevitably, and panting for further promotion, was not so much affected by other incidents which would have interested him at a more quiet period. He was not, it must be confessed, very much cast down by good old Mr. Sedley's catastrophe. He tried his new uniform, which became him very handsomely, on the day when the first meeting of the creditors of the unfortunate gentleman took place. His father told him of the wicked, rascally, shameful conduct of the bankrupt, reminded him of what he had said about Amelia, and that their connection was broken off forever. and gave him that evening a good sum of money to pay for the new clothes and the polish in which he looked so well. Money was always useful to this free-handed young fellow, and he took it without many words. The bills were up in the Sedley house, where he had passed so many, many happy hours. He could see them as he walked from home that night to the old Slaughter's, where he put up when in town, shining white in the moon. That comfortable home was shut then upon Amelia and her parents. Where had they taken refuge? The thought of their ruin affected him not a little. He was very melancholy that night in the coffee room at the Slaughter's, and drank a good deal, as his comrades remarked there. Dobbin came in presently, cautioned him about the drink, which he only took, he said, because he was too slow. But when his friend began to put to him clumsy inquiries, and asked him for news in a significant manner, Osborne declined entering into conversation with him, avowing, however, that he was devilish disturbed and unhappy. 3 days afterwards, Dobbin found Osborne in his room at the barracks, his head on the table, a number of papers about, the young captain evidently in a state of great despondency. She sent me back some things. I gave her some damn trinkets. Look here. There was a little packet directed in the well-known hand to Captain George Osborne, and some things lying about a ring, a silver knife he had bought, as a boy, for her at a fair, a gold chain, and a locket with hair in it. "'Tease all over," said he, with a groan of sickening remorse. "'L, look, Will, you may read it if you like." There was a little letter of a few lines, to which he pointed, which said, "My papa has ordered me to return to you these presents, which you made in happier days to me, and I am to write to you for the last time. I think, I know you feel as much as I do the blow which has come upon us. It is I that absolve you from an engagement which is impossible in our present misery. I am sure you had no share in it, or in the cruel suspicions of Mr. Osborne, which are the hardest of all our griefs to bear. Farewell, farewell. I pray God to strengthen me to bear this and other calamities, and to bless you always. I shall often play upon the piano your piano. It was like you to send it." Dobbin was very soft-hearted. The sight of women and children in pain always used to melt him. The idea of Amelia broken-hearted and lonely tore that good-natured soul with anguish, and he broke out into an emotion which anybody who likes may consider unmanly. He swore that Amelia was an angel, to which Osborne said aye with all his heart. He, too, had been reviewing the history of their lives, and had seen her from her childhood to her present age, so sweet, so innocent, so charmingly simple, and artlessly fond and tender. What a pang it was to lose all that. To have had it, and not prized it. 1,000 homely scenes and recollections crowded on him in which he always saw her good and beautiful. And for himself, he blushed with remorse and shame, as the remembrance of his own selfishness and indifference contrasted with that perfect purity. For a while, glory, war, everything was forgotten, and the pair of friends talked about her only. "Where are they?" Osborne asked, after a long talk, and a long pause, and, in truth, with no little shame at thinking that he had taken no steps to follow her. "Here are they? There's no address to the note." Dobbin knew. He had not merely sent the piano, but had written a note to Mrs. Sedley, and asked permission to come and see her, and he had seen her, and Amelia too, yesterday, before he came down to Chatham, and, what is more, he had brought that farewell letter and packet which had so moved them. The good-natured fellow had found Mrs. Sedley only too willing to receive him, and greatly agitated by the arrival of the piano, which, as she conjectured, must have come from George, and was a signal of amity on his part. Captain Dobbin did not correct this error of the worthy lady, but listened to all her story of complaints and misfortunes with great sympathy, condoled with her losses and privations, and agreed in reprehending the cruel conduct of Mr. Osborne towards his first benefactor. When she had eased her overflowing bosom somewhat, and poured forth many of her sorrows, he had the courage to ask actually to see Amelia, who was above in her room as usual, and whom her mother led trembling downstairs. Her appearance was so ghastly, and her look of despair so pathetic, that honest William Dobbin was frightened as he beheld it, and read the most fatal forebodings in that pale fixed face. After sitting in his company a minute or two, she put the packet into his hand, and said, "Take this to Captain Osborne, if you please, and I hope he's quite well, and it was very kind of you to come and see us, and we like our new house very much. And I think I'll go upstairs, Mama, for I'm not very strong." And with this, and a curtsy and a smile, the poor child went her way. The mother, as she led her up, cast back looks of anguish towards Dobbin. The good fellow wanted no such appeal. He loved her himself too fondly for that. Inexpressible grief, and pity, and terror pursued him, and he came away, as if he was a criminal after seeing her. When Osborne heard that his friend had found her, he made hot and anxious inquiries regarding the poor child. How was she? How did she look? What did she say? His comrade took his hand and looked him in the face. "George, she's dying," William Dobbin said, and could speak no more. There was a buxom Irish servant girl who performed all the duties of the little house where the Sedley family had found refuge. And this girl had in vain, on many previous days, striven to give Amelia aid or consolation. Emmy was much too sad to answer, or even to be aware of the attempts the other was making in her favor. 4 hours after the talk between Dobbin and Osborne, the servant maid came into Amelia's room, where she sat as usual, brooding silently over her letters, her little treasures. The girl, smiling, and looking arch and happy, made many trials to attract poor Emmy's attention, who, however, took no heed of her. "Miss Emmy," said the girl. "I'm coming," Emmy said, not looking round. "There's a message," the maid went on. "Here's something somebody sure, here's a new letter for you, don't be reading them old ones anymore." And she gave her a letter, which Emmy took, and read. "I must see you," the letter said. "Dearest Emmy, dearest love, dearest wife, come to me." George and her mother were outside, waiting until he had read the letter. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.